from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner sees a Western Fed intrigue playing out at home and a demonization campaign in full swing in Western media, she's returning from a summit in Beijing with China's President Xi Jinping with a briefcase full of goodies for her country. At home, right-wing politicians are trying to place a cloud on her over events surrounding the death of Alberto Nisman, a former prosecutor who had accused the president of attempting to shield Iran from claims by Israel that the Islamic Republic was responsible for a 1994 bombing of a Jewish center in Buenos Aires. In the Western media, which has likewise been intimating that the president was somehow connected to Nisman's death, despite a complete lack of evidence to support such a claim, there was also featured Thursday a tweet purportedly from the president that included apparent ridicule of the accents of her Chinese hosts. Nevertheless, China took a number of major steps toward closer economic and financial cooperation with Buenos Aires. We have more in this report from CCTV.
China and Argentina have signed a series of deals, including collaboration on two new nuclear power plants. The pacts were signed following a meeting Wednesday in Beijing between Chinese President Xi Jinping and his Argentine counterpart, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. A total of 15 agreements were signed, covering everything from travel visas to space technology. The Argentine leader says the two nuclear plants would be built in her country with a transfer of technology from China. She also said Argentina is willing to expand the swap line, which will make the Chinese yuan the major trade currency between the two countries.
France's President François Hollande and Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel will meet with Russia's President Vladimir Putin Friday after spending a day in Kiev Thursday. RT's Marina Deshashi has more.
The German Chancellor and French President will meet with Russia's President in Moscow this Friday. They'll discuss the Ukrainian crisis and ways to de-escalate the conflict there. Well, we can now talk to our correspondent Eunan O'Neill, who can bring us the very latest. Hi there, Eunan. Well, this is a high-profile meeting, as we know. So what more can you tell us?
Well, we know that tomorrow the German Chancellor Angela Merkel and François Hollande, French President, will arrive in the Russian capital for talks. They'll also be travelling today to Kiev to meet with President Poroshenko, Ukrainian President. Now, during the press conference that we heard a few moments ago in Paris, François Hollande said that he and Chancellor Merkel had come up with, quote, new suggestions for the conflict in East Ukraine, but that it would be agreeable for all sides and that the territory integrity of the country, that's what it shall be based on. He also called what is happening in East Ukraine a war. It is really a surprise decision at this moment because we know violence is escalating in the east of the country. We also know that Washington is considering supplying deadly arms to Kiev for the conflict in East Ukraine. Moscow says that this will only intensify the deadly conflict that is already erupting there at the moment. We also heard a few moments ago from Dmitry Peskov, the spokesperson for President Putin, that indeed the President of Russia, Chancellor of Germany and the French President will sit down for talks tomorrow.
Right now, though, we can talk to our next expert and discuss the meeting with Russia's analyst, Martin McCauley. Martin, what significance do you attach to this meeting? How big a gesture is it in this diplomatic process to find peace in eastern Ukraine?
It's very important that Chancellor Merkel and Prime Minister and President Hollande decide to go to Moscow instead of meeting Putin somewhere else. They've decided to go to Moscow. So therefore, the situation, from their point of view, is becoming serious. It's becoming very, very serious indeed in Ukraine, especially eastern Ukraine. And they want to find some solution which will halt the attacks, halt the fighting, halt the killing, and so on. And they're putting their heads together, and they say they've got new ideas and new suggestions and so on, which they will present to President Putin. But from Putin's point of view, he believes he holds all the aces, because the rebels are winning the war militarily in eastern Ukraine, and it's spreading, and they're taking more and more territory. So therefore, from his point of view, he will look at Merkel and Hollande and say, well, what can you offer me? Because I'm winning.
Well, that certainly remains to be seen here as the day progresses, and we will be getting more information as to what comes out of the meeting. And as you said, the heads will be putting, different heads will be putting to work together. Speaking of which, could this meeting also be used to talk about other issues linked to the crisis, specifically the existing sanctions against Russia? What are your thoughts?
Those are the things that President Putin will bring up, because the sanctions are really biting. They're really affecting the Russian economy. Russia needs them lightened or removed. And the German economy and the French economy really would like them to be lifted or half lifted already, so that they can get back to what the normal economic relations were before the crisis. So therefore, there's an economic interest on both sides to weaken these sanctions and get back to normal economic relations. That said, President Hollande is in the more difficult position, because the French economy is not doing very well. So he'll be the one who's more keen to make concessions so that business can start again. From the Western point of view, they don't want the Americans to escalate the conflict in Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine, because the Americans are talking about the possibility of providing anti-tank weapons, drones, better communications and so on, if you like, lethal weapons to the conflict, which would exacerbate tensions there. So Merkel and Hollande will perhaps bring that up to Putin, that if the present situation continues, then the Americans may change their mind and provide the Ukrainian army with much more effective weapons, more lethal weapons, which would in fact
Mr. McCauley, I'd like to interrupt you here, because you mentioned the United States here, and let's see what role the U.S. plays in all of this. I mean, on the one hand, we have Europeans negotiating with Putin, and as you said earlier, talking about economic sanctions, they're biting both sides here, and Europeans, specifically Hollande, will be talking about easing sanctions, possibly lifting, in the best case scenario, of course. But what is the role of the U.S. here? I mean, earlier we clearly saw the pressure of the United States on Europe when it came to sanctions. How do you see this progressing this time? That's the question about sanctions. And another one is about weapons, as you said. I mean, why then, if Washington is backing the move by France and Germany, why then would it be talking to Ukraine about sending weapons there? So what are your thoughts on these two key issues?
The key player here is the United States, because Europe on its own military can't really do anything. It's the United States, which is a key military factor here. And if they see the situation in Eastern Ukraine deteriorating, if they see attacks on Mariupol, and perhaps even as far as east or west as Odessa, with the Ukrainian forces losing, then Kiev will come to Washington and say, we need more effective weapons. We can't really defeat the separatists as it is. Our weapons aren't good enough. Our soldiers aren't trained well enough. Therefore, we need more effective weapons. Now, that is hanging over these negotiations, because Merkel and Hollande will not decide those factors, the military factor. They will be talking about economic, and they'll be appealing for peace and so on, because in the end, the key decision maker is President Obama. And so far, he's been unwilling to arm the Kievan forces and the Kievan military with very effective weapons. They always talk about lethal weapons turning the tide, but if they provided lethal weapons, this would in fact exacerbate the tension, and perhaps the fighting would spread, and it might in fact involve Ukraine and the Soviet Union, Ukraine and the United States in a proxy war.
Yeah, Mr. McCauley, just very quickly, we don't have very much time left. As you said rightly, the tension is already high there in this region, and efforts should be made to defuse it. But very quickly, if you could, are you optimistic that something could come out of this meeting today?
I think that both sides will clarify their positions. That's what would come out of it. The Hollande and Merkel will present the European Union point of view very, very clearly. And Merkel obviously speaks Russian, and there's no language problem there. So therefore, she can communicate directly with Putin to try and understand his point of view. So he has to declare his point of view, and the European Union will present their point of view. And then when Merkel and Hollande go back to Germany and France, they can communicate with Washington, say, this is the conclusion that we've come to from these talks, these negotiations with President Putin. Here's his position, and we put our suggestions and so on, and now we leave it up to President Putin to act.
More civilian casualties from another shelling of Donetsk by the Ukrainian military. We have this from Press TV.
Fighting rages on in unabated in East Ukraine. At least 19 people have lost their lives in 24 hours in the latest spate of violent clashes there. Officials say the victims included 14 civilians and 5 government soldiers. Pro-Russia militias say 8 civilians were killed in Donetsk shelling, while Ukrainian officials say 6 civilians died in a government-held territory. Fighting between the Ukrainian army forces and pro-Russia militias has intensified in recent months in the country's volatile east. Both sides are now moving to call up more troops. Kiev accuses Moscow of fueling the bloody feud by supporting pro-Russia forces fighting the Ukrainian government. Russia denies the allegation.
Ukraine's parliament passed a law Thursday authorizing military commanders to use physical force against army defectors. The move comes as the latest military draft has seen a lack of enthusiasm on the part of potential soldiers. An explanatory note to the legislative document said that there were currently mass violations of military discipline, in particular, desertion from units and drinking alcohol, as well as a failure to execute commander's orders. In late January, a new Ukrainian military draft came into effect, the fourth wave of mobilization since Kiev launched military operations against eastern Ukraine in April of last year. The draft was expected to add 100,000 more people to the army in 3 stages over the course of 2015. However, the country's defense ministry said last Saturday that nearly 7,500 Ukrainians already face criminal charges for draft evasion. Meanwhile, NATO continues to ratchet up tensions. The alliance's secretary general, ahead of a defense minister's meeting in Brussels, said Thursday the NATO Rapid Response Force in Europe could be increased to 30,000 troops from the current 13,000. Most of the troops are set to be stationed near Russia's borders.
The Commission of Inquiry on the Democratic People's Republic of Korea has found systematic, widespread, and grave human rights violations occurring in that country. It has also found a disturbing array of crimes against humanity.
That was Judge Michael Kirby, as the Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in North Korea presented its report to the UN Human Rights Council last March.
These crimes are committed against inmates of political and other prison camps, against starving populations, against religious believers, against persons who try to flee the country, including those forcibly repatriated by China. These crimes arise from policies established at the highest level of the state. They have been committed and continue to take place in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea because the policies, institutions, and patterns of impunity that lie at their heart remain in place. The gravity, scale, duration, and nature of the unspeakable atrocities committed in the country reveal a totalitarian state that does not have any parallel in the contemporary world.
The report said that its findings were based on testimony from hundreds of victims, defectors, and witnesses. Nevertheless, as it turns out, most of the factual allegations came from one primary source, Shin Dong-hyuk, the West's most celebrated North Korean defector, who has since been caught lying to the United Nations, Human Rights Watch, and others. According to a report at the website liberationnews.org, that witness, quote, according to his own statements, purposefully falsified the main chronological and geographical aspects of his life story, a fantastic story of inhuman gulags in North Korea that has been broadcast all over the world as the central argument that the country, in the words of the UN Commission of Inquiry on North Korea, quote, is the worst human rights violator on the planet, close quote. Shin Dong-hyuk is literally the global voice and face of the human rights campaign that Western countries have waged against the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, a campaign that most observers see as part of a wider U.S. strategy of regime change. For more on this, we spoke with Brian Becker from the Answer Coalition from his office in Washington, D.C. via Skype Thursday. At the U.N. and in the public discourse, North Korea has been facing all kinds of difficulties over alleged human rights violations there. And now it comes out that one of the primary sources used for the alleged human rights violations was lying. You want to talk about that?
Sure. The UN human rights rapporteur, Marzuki Darusman, has been making the assertion and got a resolution passed at the UN General Assembly calling for the North Korean government, and particularly its head of state, Kim Jong-un, to be referred to the International Criminal Court for human rights violations, which include a listing of the most kind of grotesque and brutal, barbaric treatment of prisoners and those who object to the policies of the government, and particularly those who are purportedly held in these gulag prison camps, Camp 12, Camp 14, they're called. And the main evidence, I would say the single biggest piece of the evidence from what the human rights rapporteur identifies as witness number one, and that would be Shin Dong-hyuk, the man who wrote a book with the help of someone else in 2012 saying my escape from Camp 14. His evidence was the evidence presented to indict and have this resolution passed against North Korea. It turns out that most of his story, which includes the fact that he was born in a prison camp, that he, at age, I believe, six, reported that his mother and brother had attempted to escape, leading to their execution, and other grotesque stories, that none of that happens to be true. And the North Korean government has been able to present evidence that is now taken as good coin, even by the New York Times, that shows that, in fact, this individual, Shin Dong-hyuk, is just a pathological liar, or I would say a pathological liar in the pay of U.S. intelligence services. He's been making the rounds all around the world. His book was the number one bestseller. He was pictured with George W. Bush in Texas at the Bush Library a year ago, taking pictures. He's like the guy who's been used as the source for all of the allegations against North Korea. And now it turns out that it's not true. I mean, he was on 60 Minutes. He was in the New York Times. He was on CNN. Human Rights and Amnesty International and many, many others all used the testimony, the lying testimony of Shin Dong-hyuk as the basis for their allegations against North Korea.
So the resolution against North Korea calling for the referral of the North Korean leadership to the ICC taking place in the General Assembly, of course, that's not sufficient for a referral, right? It has to go through the Security Council?
Right. It's basically
it's political.
The General Assembly resolution really doesn't have the force of law in within the United Nations structure. It would have to go through the Security Council.
Right.
What they're, and of course, I don't think that would possibly get through the Security Council. Neither China nor Russia will agree to this.
Exactly.
But what's happening is that the UN rapporteur, Marzuki Darusman, is using the resolution to generate a new next wave of hysteria against North Korea.
Right.
Now, it's important to know, by the way, that not only was the number one witness lying, and it's been admitted now that he's lying, that he was not born in a prison camp. His father said he was never born in a prison camp. His father says the whole thing is an entire fabrication. And the author of the book, who he co-authored with, said huge parts of the story are now proven to be untrue. But Marzuki Darusman, the UN rapporteur for human rights, who is he? He was the prosecutor general for General Suharto in Indonesia.
Whoa.
between 1999 and 2001. Now, General Suharto had the worst human rights record anywhere in the world. Suharto came to power in a 1965 coup in Indonesia, sponsored by the CIA, that took the lives of a million Indonesians at least. They killed hundreds of thousands of Indonesian communists. The Suharto government invaded and occupied and killed activists in East Timor. Right. And so this individual, who was the general prosecutor for Suharto, is now the advocate of human rights in North Korea. I mean, just on its face, that is clearly discrediting to the whole operation, and also shows that the entire human rights allegations against North Korea are politics. It's not about an objective assessment of human rights in North Korea. It's about politics, and the politics are creating a hysteria against a government that has been targeted for regime change by the United States. And Dar Osman, the rapporteur, has said 2 days ago, and quoted by the New York Times in its editorial, that the only way, the only single way for North Korea to remedy its human rights problem would be for the removal of the cult leadership system in North Korea, including the Kim Jong-un family. Now, here's the human rights rapporteur demanding regime change as the only avenue to correct what he purports to be a human rights problem. That demonstrates that this is nothing but politics, and the politics is, again, have the United States demonize a targeted government like Saddam Hussein in 2003, or North Korea, or Iran, or President Assad in Syria, or Gaddafi in Libya, to prepare the population for carrying out other illegal military covert and overt operations to format regime change. And that's what this story is really all about.
And this happens at the same time that this movie thing, where they essentially advocate the, as a comedy event, advocate the assassination of the leader of the North Korean government.
Right. So the interview, the so-called interview, the movie comes out showing the assassination of a head of state, Kim Jong-un. The Sony Corporation is hacked, a major hack, exposing that the top leadership of Sony is racist, that they're thieves, that they're carrying out all kinds of illegal activity. Most people, insiders in the industry, think that that hack came from within Sony. And yet the United States government, including President Obama in his end of the year press conference, asserts categorically that not only was Sony hacked, but that North Korea clearly and demonstrably was the aggressor, even though no evidence is purported. So you have a movie coming out calling for showing Kim Jong-un's assassination. You have the President of the United States standing with Sony Corporation, insisting that North Korea has hacked the corporation, and saying that the U.S. will take commensurate actions against North Korea. At the same time, it comes out that the United States, through cyber attacks in 2010 and 2012, completely took over North Korea's own computer system, well before the movie The Interview or the hack of Sony. And at the same time, the United States is carrying out massive war games. The biggest war exercises in the whole year will be taking place starting in 2 weeks on North Korea's border, in its waters, simulating the bombing and invasion and takeover of North Korea. That's what these war games do. They simulate the assault against North Korea, which isn't that funny to North Korea, because the United States actually did that to North Korea in 1950, and 5 million Koreans, 3 million from North Korea, died while the United States bombed every building in the country. The main complaint of U.S. pilots at that time was that there was nothing left to bomb. Yeah. The United States used napalm all over the country. And so here you have a combination of UN allegations, a movie, the assertions by the U.S. president that the North Koreans are engaged in cyber warfare, while at the same time the U.S. is actually preparing for a war exercise that simulate the invasion of North Korea and imposes extreme economic sanctions to deprive the country of food and medicine. So you have this kind of Alice in Wonderland upside-down reality created, where the victims of aggression are targeted as the criminals, that they're the perpetrators of the grossest human rights violations. Again, not because of an objective assessment of what's going on in North Korea, but for politics. I was in North Korea a year ago during the anniversary of the armistice that brought North Korea and the American and North Korea military conflict to an end in 1953. You know, the UN report says that North Korea is deliberately starving its own people. I mean, that's an unusual thing for a government to do, to deliberately starve its own people. But when I was in North Korea, you could see the fields were planted, the crops, the corn, the rice was growing plentifully. That the whole image that this country is prostrate and in a position of extreme, utter starvation, none of that happens to be true. And so we, the American people, and those who are fighting for justice and progress, I mean, we have an obligation to stand up against demonization, to expose it, and to show what it's really all about, which is preparing the United States population for a new aggression in another part of the world.
You know, the same scenario has been played out in so many places, but one of the places that they've been trying to do this as well, with some intensity lately, is Venezuela. And there were a couple of revelations, though, that sort of rolled back the curtain on the attempt to, essentially an attempt to provoke the government into doing something that would then be able to be taken to the UN to condemn them for human rights violations, as has been done several times before. And that was the cutting off the food supply in the warehouses, you know, the private corporations that manage goods in at the retail and wholesale level there. They're holding all just individual items that are necessities and or, you know, expected conveniences of life back so that people had to queue. And they were caught plotting with some of the opposition leaders there to incite riots at these food lines so that then it would provoke a response against the supporters of the government by the police.
Yes, this is, you know, Don, we have seen this scenario played out over and over and over again. Let's just think back to the other September 11th, 1973 in Chile, when a U.S.-backed, CIA-backed military counter-revolution coup d'état destroyed the attempt by the Allende government to carry out a peaceful transition to socialism. That's what they were trying to do, to say, yes, we're going to use nonviolent, peaceful methods to legislate socialism in. And what the CIA did, working with the elites in Chile, is they carried out sort of the sabotage of the Chilean economy, depriving especially the middle class of food and commodities that it had been accustomed to and it, you know, considered to be sort of fundamental, and created economic destabilization, a strike by capital against labor, in other words, a strike to withhold, a strike to create shortages. This was a deliberate CIA strategy carried out in cahoots with the Chilean military, with Pinochet, to soften the population up for the eventual military coup d'etat. Now, what Maduro in Venezuela and what the Party for Socialism in Venezuela says is that they are enduring what they characterize as a slow motion coup d'etat, that the elites in Venezuela, and in Venezuela, even though they have a revolutionary government and the leadership wants to move in the direction of socialism, it's still a class society. It has great amounts of polarization. A large amount of the country's wealth and land is still controlled by the capitalists and the bourgeoisie and the landowners. Those forces working with the Obama administration and the CIA are attempting to sabotage and create food shortages. Again, just as you said, if there's enough human suffering, people will rise up, or sections of the population will rise up, and they will become the human materiel for a coup d'etat.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.